From theunce.com, this is The Unce Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunce.com. Hello and welcome to The Unce Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. The jam and electronica communities have been bummed out with the recent news that pioneer Livetronica act The New Deal will be ending their 12-year career after this summer. In an effort to capture the impact The New Deal has had on the electronic music scene, The Unce will bring you interviews with TND members throughout this festival season. We begin with a two-part interview with drummer Darren Shearer. This percussive monster has made a career out of sounding like a drum machine and doing spot-on impressions of Mark Brownstein. When we last spoke about a year ago, I never got a chance to ask you about your own musical background and development. You're one of the best drummers out there in the game today. I think a lot of people are curious about your first experiences with music and drumming specifically.
Well, yeah, I've been drumming since, the womb kind of thing, and I'd always been tapping on things, and, I think my teachers never really knew what to do with me, but my mom was always very artistically inclined and very inclined to, to want to encourage that in us as well. And so very early I, chopsticks on the sofa kind of thing, and was always playing along with different music. And eventually I was making enough noise about it that I earned a snare drum, a practice pad, and a pair of drumsticks. And it was sort of like, if you can do this and if you can take some lessons, then you can, then maybe we'll look at getting you a drum set later. And I think I did one lesson and I hated it. It was just like, right, left, ref, right, left, right, left, like whatever, paradiddles or stick rudiments that they were throwing at me. And by the end of it, I just said, this is not for me. But I continued drumming, and my uncle actually was a pretty famous drummer. He played with a group called, we played in a band with Ronnie Hawkins, Ronnie Hawkins was like a very legendary sort of, almost like a ringmaster of musicians in Canada.
Yeah, absolutely, the band.
Exactly, and my uncle actually replaced Levon in the Ronnie Hawkins band when Levon went to go, when they went to go play with Dylan. That's actually how they got the name The Band, was because they moved from Canada down to Woodstock, where Dylan was, and they became Dylan's band, but everyone referred to them as The Band. So it'd be like, oh yeah, where's The Band? Oh, The Band. And so eventually, when they left Dylan, they just became The Band. And my uncle replaced Levon in the Ronnie Hawkins band, I can't remember what, 60-something, and he had become quite a fixture in Canadian music, my uncle was, and so he gave me my first drum set that I still have, actually. And I had thought that it was Levon's set, because Levon had sold a set to my uncle. My uncle still stays in touch with him, but I found out later that this is not Levon's set. But I kind of feel like I'm like almost entitled to lie that it is.
You are. I think you've earned that.
Yeah. But my uncle was a big a big supporter of me, a big proponent of me, like wanting to actually, be a drummer and pursue that. My father, not ever like outright saying, no, I don't want you to do this, but not so much musically and artistically inclined and wanting to move me to do more business oriented things. But I just began playing, and I've literally been a professional drummer right out of high school. Like I played in a band that got a record deal right out of high school, and we're touring the country and such. And that band actually lasted right up until the New Deal began. So I've really only played like for real in two different bands. Like I've obviously sat in with lots of different groups and played different studio stuff and what have you. But it's mainly been two bands since the beginning.
What was that first band like? What sort of styles were encompassed in that act?
We were like a funk band. We played like a funk. We had like 3-piece horn section. We were, we had this, dreadlocked James Brownie, Bob Marley, like meets Bob Marley kind of lead singer. Mm-hmm. And we were quite good, actually. The band was called Gypsy Soul, and we got a major record deal with A&M Records, and we. We put some videos out, and we were quite popular in Canada, but no one makes money in a 7-piece,
Right.
Unless you're like Humphries McGee, you know, you didn't know.
They're missing a couple of numbers there.
I don't know. How many people does Humphries have? They've got like, they got two drummer percussionist guys. They got
two guitarists,
guitar players, a bass player, a keyboard player, and
yeah, it's six.
They're six. They're six piece.
One short. That if they added another member, suddenly they would stop making money altogether.
You know what? No, Vince, although he's the manager, he is kind of the seventh member of Humphries.
That's true. How are they going to do the Metallica covers without him?
Yeah, that's true. So that's kind of my story. It's fairly simple. I started playing hand drum right, like almost before I was playing drum kit too. So I've also specialized in African and Latin American percussion as well. So I've sort of been doing the both things and coming and trying to sort of take elements of both and incorporate them into each other.
Guelph. Before the New Deal officially started, though, you were playing. There were some jazz elements to your sound, though, right? Were you schooled in that at all, or did you just listen to Gene Krupa or Billy Cobham and Art Blakey all day and sort of teach yourself these techniques and fundamentals?
Well, I played in a very specific sort of early to mid '90s genre called acid jazz, and acid jazz really was. It's kind of what like. You know how kind of like rock now has like incorporated electro into it. It was sort of like what jazz incorporated electro into it, and it was something that became very very popular in Toronto for sure. But also like if you look at there's a group out of New York City called the Groove Collective way back in the day, and Jamiroquai came out of that. Brand New Heavies, like a lot of these acid jazz groups, and
maybe Medeski Martin and Wood also in that New York sound.
Yeah, Medeski Martin and Wood kind of came more a little bit out of the avant-garde jazz scene and a bit more out of like the legit like jazz players kind of thing. Where this was a bit more like kind of funky, soulful kind of thing. And I always like sort of was drawn to groove-based music. And I the one problem I always have with jazz, unless it's like you know. I always feel like I'm waiting for the groove to drop in jazz for a lot of the time, even with some of the great drummers. And I know I'd probably get slammed for saying that, but I am. I'm waiting for like the downbeat. You know what I mean? So with this, I really love this form of music. And I had this residency in Toronto at this sort of like packed, you know, sort of social hangout place in downtown Toronto called the Bohemian Cafe. And every Thursday night I would have different musicians. So I'd have players from all these different bands and you know, and all like really great players, and we come out and you know I'd pay everyone $75 and they get a pitcher of beer and good night, you know, kind of thing. And and we'd play to like sort of a somewhat half bored audience that didn't really understand what we were doing. And I began to bring out Dan and Jamie because the fact that they we kind of shared this similar magnetism towards taking acid jazz and making it a bit more electronic, maybe even a bit more rigid, a bit more
maybe computerized or programmed.
Yeah, well, nothing we ever did like maybe emulating computer or program, but maybe like sort of a bit more like methodical and a bit more mathematic in how we're sort of positioning all the different you know verses, choruses, heads, all those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And we began to play and we're like, wow, this is actually pretty cool. And this scene that we're playing in is like, wow, it's pretty lame. So we decided to kind of pull out of this thing. And we played our first show ever at the Comfort Zone in Toronto. It's this little like after hours rave club in the basement of this, this old building in Toronto. And we that was our first show, and we recorded that show in front of 10 people. And we always, and this is our big claim to fame, is that Feist was one of those people who was in the audience, and Tyler Stewart, Tyler Stewart from Bare Naked Ladies was in the audience, and Jamie's future wife, who we didn't even know yet, was in the audience, but there were only about 15 people there.
Out of 10 people at a show in Canada, you got Feist, you got Bare Naked Ladies, you got a wife coming in there. Yeah. That's pretty good odds. That's 30%.
It's not bad at all. It was good. It was definitely VIPs. And, so we played the show, and that show became our record, This Is Live. And that was our first show we ever played together. It was all improvised, and we recorded it. Our sound guy also happened to be – he ended up being our sound guy to this day. He's been our sound guy for 12 years. He recorded it onto cassette tape, and he recorded it over top of an old there's a jam band from Canada called the Bert Nielsen Band. And there was an old Bert Nielsen Band demo cassette, and he recorded our set on over top of this thing on this cassette. And then we took this music, we threw it into a computer, cleaned it up, and we released it as This Is Live. And that's been our best-selling record to date, was our first show ever played.
And while some tracks on there like Bullet and maybe Back to the Middle have that acid jazz sound, tracks like Stinger and Dopamine really capture that sort of low-key drum and bass and break sound that would eventually become huge for you. I mean, but before that now, Mythical Jam, did you have any conversation about where you wanted to go? Was there any indication that you wanted to maybe move beyond the realms of jazz and get spacey and even move into that cutting edge electronic music, or was it just something the three of you were into and it happened absolutely organically?
It honestly, like, without trying to sound, you know, mystical and you know, and even cliche on the whole thing, it's like it really was natural. Like, we didn't have to do anything. Like, we all knew, like, at that point Dan and Jamie were listening to a lot of the sort of new I'm trying to think of some of the groups around that time. There's a record label called Interchill at the time that was owned by a friend of theirs, Andrew Ross Collins, and they were putting out a lot of cool stuff. And a lot of the sort of more, like, there was a lot of sort of like Thievery Corporation-y kind of stuff.
Sure, down tempo with some breaks in there, but not overwhelming.
Exactly, and that's really what we were sounding like. But then we started to notice that there was more people coming to our shows, and there was more people. And the second you have more people in front of you, you're like, oh, how do we get this crowd moving? And so our tempo started to increase. We start to like kind of beef up our sound a little bit more. You know, Jamie moved away from the fluttery sort of ambient sounds and really starting to get into like how to actually like how to like hit the real rhythmic pulse of techno and house music and stuff like that with the keyboards and us really sort of starting to put together and become more like a house kind of group as opposed to it being
background music even.
Exactly.
Dopamine from the New Deal's debut show and album, This Is Live. You've been such a huge influence on acts like Umphrey's and the Biscuits and their crowds. The jam scene as a whole has been so supportive of you, and I believe it is because you progressed as a live act. You really began to hone in on that ebb and flow and the ages-long builds that explode and really get that type of audience off. When was it that you began to notice that this was the sound and the technique that you needed to explore in order to maybe bolster your live performances, that massive build and that pulsing rhythmic feel that sort of crescendos to the climax?
I think really honestly, like it was a natural progression because we began to have more people in front of us, and we noticed that when we did the more up-tempo stuff, people like really rocked out. And just as a musician, like we've never been the navel gazer kind of musician. Like we've always been very much interested in playing for the audience. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. It's not like our art that people must listen to, and if they don't like it, they can screw off. No, it's always been an interactive thing that we all You know, I feel like I look at the audience, okay, they're not really feeling, 125 BPM right now. They'd like to go a little higher. Okay, cool, let's bring it up to 135 or whatever. Like, you can really gauge it, and that's the beauty and that's the luxury of playing in an improvised band, is that you really can gauge the audience, and that's what we've done from the beginning, is gauge the audience as to where they're at and what they want to be doing. And, that's one thing, in bands I've played with in the past where you're sort of hogtied to a tempo or to a song, and you're looking at the audience, you're like, yeah, they really want to kind of do something different. You can't really do that.
You've got three more verses and a couple of choruses, and then, you got to stay within that structure.
Totally. And now we it's very simple. We just change gears. You know what I mean? Like then that's the beauty of it. So I think that really honestly, it was a very natural progression, and it continues to be too. Like as our sound evolves, we're very much, I guess you could say, sponges for the music that we listen to, you know what I mean? And we can actually, we can just go out there and away from each other and listen to the music we want to listen to and play in other bands. And when we come back, we definitely bring back a little bit of what we've been listening to and what we've been absorbing, and then that will find itself in a New Deal show, which is kind of cool. And that's really how the New Deal has progressed, because we've never really talked about our music. We've talked about gear, like Jamie will be like, I'm going to introduce a couple new keyboards, and I introduced an electro pad, and mm-hmm. and Dan's obviously been evolving his sound through his bass rig, and now adding bass synth and stuff like that. That being said, it's very much been about the idea that we don't want to talk about it. Like one of my favorite moments in the band The Join, which was sort of taking the New Deal
that aesthetic to another level.
Yeah, taking the sort of the New Deal business model musically and bringing it to other musicians. And I remember Mark Brownstein, we were playing, I think in Atlantic City or something, and we're about to go on stage, and he's like, "Okay, what song are we starting with?" And I'm like, I don't know. We don't know what song we're starting. We're just start playing. He's like, "What do you mean? Like, how do we know what to play?" You know? And it was just like, this is what we're starting. We're just starting. And then within 15 seconds, he's like, "Oh, okay. I get this. This is what we do." You know? And Mark and Aaron are awesome in that kind of capacity, because they're proficient, and they get where we're coming from on it. But there's been some musicians who just like, it freaks them out too much. It's just like,
I'm sure.
What do you mean? I remember getting up in front of 10,000 people at Langerado a bunch of years ago. We hadn't, I hadn't even seen Jamie or Dan for 3 months. We hadn't seen each other. We'd come off a break and we didn't get to sound check or anything. And we just walked on stage and we just played the show.
Yeah.
And it was one of my favorite shows of that era. You know what I mean? And it's like, and that goes to show you, it's like, you know, not to say that you shouldn't rehearse or things like that, whatever, but I hate rehearsing. And I'd rather just go up there and bang it off.
That concludes part one of the UNS podcast interview with Darren Shearer of The New Deal. Check back in tomorrow with the UNS to hear the rest of the interview. We talk about Four on the Floor, The New Deal's summer tour, and Darren's future plans. Special thanks go to Drew Grancelli with The New Deal and, of course, my guest, Darren Shearer. Tonight marks the beginning of The New Deal's last run. They'll be hitting the National in Richmond, Virginia with Subswara and former champions, then Philly's Electric Factory, Sonar in Baltimore, and the legendary Terminal 5 in New York City, Thursday through Saturday. Those three dates will feature Ott and Subswara. Remember to visit theunce.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum. You can still win tickets to Electric Forest Festival to catch one of the last New Deal shows, as well as a couple of big Yodo dates in Chicago this weekend. Hurry though, we're in the final stretch for those tickets.
and go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review. Tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, or you'd like to be a guest on the UNS podcast, contact me at anand@theunce.com. That's A-N-A-N-D @theunce.com. We'll see you tomorrow.